A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to this really special edition of the Explaining History podcast. In a moment, we're going to be hearing from myself in conversation with Andrew Scott, aka Otto English, the writer and journalist with Byline Times, who is now the author of a brilliant new book, Fake History. It's really important we have this conversation, I think, because we are in an era of kind of informational crisis, really. This was abundantly clear with the kind of the surge of right-wing populism and Donald Trump and the era of mass political lying. Well, one area where we, and this is nothing new, continue to kind of collaborate with sometimes politicians, sometimes celebrities and entertainers, in our own confusion, in our own kind of in misleading ourselves, is with the misunderstanding of history and the willful kind of embrace of historical myth. And it's not to say that any one of us has a monopoly on true history, but there are, you know, historians don't so much create facts as kind of work with interpretations old and new. And there are certain things which are being proven, you know, empirically to be demonstrably untrue. And a great many of those feature in Boris Johnson's book, The Churchill Factor, which is something we will tear a strip off in just a moment. But without further ado, I'm very pleased, very proud to welcome Otto to the Explaining History podcast, and here in our special feature length episode of the show, we talk about fake history. Okay, so I'd like to welcome to the Explaining History podcast, or if you're watching this on YouTube, the Explaining History YouTube channel, Otto English. who is a I write it, correct in saying a writer and journalist and author of an excellent new book, Fake History, which we're going to talk about in depth. Otto is a the pen name of Andrew Scott, who we have with us here. So firstly, welcome to the show. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me on there. Thank
One of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation today is because we're at a period of time, perhaps as a result of the technology that we have, the internet, and the fact that we exist in this kind of online Wild West, where it's perhaps easier to fake history, to create total fantasy narratives than it has ever been. How do you think we've reached this moment where so many people are so extraordinarily confused about so much? Just to give you an easy starter question.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I agree that there's a huge amount of fake history about. There's also the means to check it. But for the first time in history, pretty much everybody in the Western world, in particular, around the world, has the ability to access the information in the device in their pocket and to check whether something is true. But and it's not just in history, across the board, people don't do that. There was an extraordinary thing last night where a Northern Irish lord tweeted angrily about the Spanish football team apparently not knowing the lyrics to the Spanish national anthem, clearly unaware that the national anthem has no lyrics. Well, rather than making a fool of himself, he could have checked that, as I did myself this morning. And it's the same principle with history. People go along with the narratives that they've grown up with, that they've been taught, which they've gleaned from somebody in a pub. They tell the stories, they like the stories. And they become a sort of alternative history because if you repeat something enough, it becomes that alternative history. And I think there's a good example of that in the story of King Canute. There's the sort of origin myth of King Canute, which is that he was trying to stop the tide, and it was an act of arrogance. And then there's the sort of clever alternative version, which is but really, he was showing that nobody, not even a king, is more powerful than the ocean. In fact, both of those stories are made up. Both of those stories are fake history. There's no evidence King Canute ever tried to stop the tide.
I remember there was a series of conversations with Eric Hobsbawm years ago, when I think it was with Melvyn Bragg, and Eric Hobsbawm had something I think was really fascinating to say on the transmission of stories. And he said industrialization kind of stopped that because centuries ago across Europe, Asia, and Africa, mums and dads would go out and work in the fields, and children would be reared by grandparents, and grandparents were the repositories of stories. And the kind of modernity has shattered that. And he said that part of our ahistorical times, the fact that we have this kind of tiny historical memory that other generations appear to not have had. That this, in his view, and he might be right on, perhaps this is a question for sociologists or anthropologists, that there's been this huge disruption in that process doesn't really happen anymore. And we have instead, systems of formalized education, which do a lot, to help shape this view of the past. I'm not saying that GCSE or A level history is like a perfect thing, and you have to do an awful lot more to develop critical understandings of the past. But that's our vehicle for the most part in terms of formal education. But the kind of the pedagogy of history now is in other hands. I, as a history teacher, every year, one of my most dreaded moments, and if any of my year 10s are listening to this, I apologise, but you've got to have some hard truths here, is when they come into the classroom, the first day of year 10, the first day of the GCSEs, and they say, are we doing Hitler then? As if he was the only person to have existed in the 20th century. And because they've come pre-armed, because they know about him from popular culture. And so the first fortnight is trying to kind of deprogram their Hitlerized brains. I'm not suggesting they're like the Hitler Youth or anything, but suggesting this story that you've heard is not true, and or it's beside the point. It's not what we understand here. Anyway.
That's the cartoon Hitler.
Yeah.
Is a menace. He's the sort of Darth Vader or something sitting in history,
yeah.
Who has been sort of cloaked, you know, to continue the Darth Vader metaphor, has been cloaked in all of these myths himself. And I find the whole continued fascination with Hitler, but all enables him in many ways. The Hitler we believe in is the Hitler Hitler wanted people to believe in,
yeah.
A sort of demagogue who who was a brilliant orator and all of these kinds of things. And people repeat it, and they repeat it over and over again. If you've ever read Mein Kampf, which I did when writing the book, it's astonishing how. I mean, it's not astonishing. It's incredibly dull. And very stupid and obviously very, very racist. But what struck me most about Mein Kampf was how dull it was. I mean, on and on he goes. I compare it in the book. It's like being accosted by someone at a bus stop who tries to tell you how good they were at art when they were doing their SATs or something like that. I mean, it's remarkable. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
One of the things Ian Kershaw has often said about Hitler in his various books on him was one of the great questions is how this rather mundane man rose to such immense power. And if he had a talent at all, I think it was spying an opportunity. I mean, that's the way that I've come to understand it. But this figure on the very periphery of German politics before the Great Depression, who was written off as this, for most sort of bourgeois Germans, this rather preposterous character down in Bavaria, who they think, oh my God, not him again, you know. But when you read about the kind of the pre-careers of people like Bolsonaro in Brazil, it's very similar. It's this rather ridiculous character that was on the radio and happens rather
or even in this country where you get ludicrous people who make ludicrous things up and then manage to get the country out of an enormous trade block. But make any of those comparisons and people come down on you like a ton of bricks.
Well this brings us neatly on to my first question. I know in the first chapter in Fake History is focused around the mythology of Winston Churchill. I couldn't estimate how many books have been written about Churchill, many of them written by himself, but in Churchill was the first myth maker of Churchill, you know. He was, and he quite consciously did it. But we reached, I mean, the nadir, the absolute low point of all Churchill writing, I won't even call it scholarship because it's not, is Boris Johnson's book, The Churchill Factor. And any fool can write a book like that. But how have we reached a point where it got published by a serious publisher? How was that even possible? Because this is the great question for me.
Yeah, well, how did we get to the point where people, I say this often about people like Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg. You know, I mean, I was at a private boarding school back in the 80s. There were Jacob Rees-Moggs and Boris Johnsons at every corner, you know. These sort of hugely self-satisfied people who had learned a few clever bits of quotations here and there from their Latin and Greek lessons and who trotted them out, and who were sort of imbued with enormous self-confidence and a sense of privilege because that's what public schools do. Mm. They make people feel entitled. And so the most entitled people within the most entitled school in this country, which is Eton, are going to be sort of uber entitled beings. Yes. And that's what you get with Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg. It's largely a veneer of being an academic. Well, they're not academics, but a veneer of supreme intelligence. And it's very convincing, and British people, particularly English people, continue to buy into this stuff. Put somebody with scruffy hair and a posh accent, on TV, throwing out a few bits of Latin, and people remain impressed. Depressingly, they remain impressed. Whereas, So Boris Johnson has done this throughout his life. He's bluffed his way along. You know, mm-hmm. the man barely, I get the impression, barely reads. And reading an article in The Guardian about his proposal for writing the Shakespeare biography. I don't know if you saw that.
I think I did, yes.
Yeah, it was very telling how he wrote the Churchill one. Mm-hmm. So according to that source, he got other people to do the legwork, academics, to write down sort of sparks notes or let's notes of Churchill's life, and then he riffed off it. Mm. Now I think that therefore sunk within that book there are some truths and some facts, but Johnson has taken it and then just riffed off the top of it and has clearly taken people out to lunch and been told stories and then dictated them into a how he does it. That's how he's done the work. So why did a publisher do that? Well, obviously the name Boris Johnson on the book sells copies. Boris Johnson has positioned himself as a sort of latter day Winston Churchill. So it's a good fit. It's a commercial prospect. And so you can see people going along with that. And I'm sure they shifted and continue to shift because I saw it in W.H. Smith's here in Lewisham the other day, mm-hmm. a lot of copies of that book. But it is shot through with bad history, anecdotes, which are easily disprovable. And this very obvious determination to draw parallels between himself and Churchill for his own political purposes. And, you know, as we all know, throughout history, people have used books throughout modern history in particular, have used books to further themselves. Trump did it with The Art of the Deal. Hitler did it with Mein Kampf.
To some extent, what's happened here? I mean, in a way, to take the sympathetic view of some publishing executive, if somebody said, well, this book will sell, 200,000 copies, and, your job kind of is kind of on the line to make sure we shift units. I have a sort of a grudging sympathy with that. I mean, what would I do? You know, I don't declare myself to be kind of as morally upright in these sorts of situations as anybody else. But in terms of almost the responsibilities of a publishing house, those seem to have become completely fallen by the wayside here. Perhaps they've gone down this route, which many a poor sap has gone down in the past of going, well, we'll trust Johnson to do this properly. you know. For international viewers and listeners, we are currently in 14 days going to have all COVID restrictions lifted, because we are trusting Boris Johnson to manage public health in Great Britain during a pandemic properly. Okay, and I'll let you draw your conclusions about what's going to happen next. The thing as well, I mean, I've, in my many years of working in bookshops, there were books called, like, you know, Churchill and the Churchill's Witty Remarks, which are probably full of things he didn't say.
I have a copy. I have a copy of the exact book you're talking about. It's called The Wit and Wisdom of Winston Churchill. And fascinatingly, there is also out there a book called The Wit and Wisdom of Boris Johnson. I don't know if you know that.
Written by
one of his, oh God, I'm now going to forget the guy's name. It's one of his super fans. I think they might even have been at school together. Who's thrown it out, which I've also flicked through. I won't claim I've dipped my hand in my pocket for that one. No. But, so, you know, and there's no wit and wisdom in that. And as to the wit and wisdom of Winston Churchill, you're right. I mean, I have a dictionary of quotations sitting here, an old-fashioned Oxford dictionary of quotations, which I went through whilst writing the book. And a significant proportion of the quotes and stories attributed to Churchill are attributed. Yeah. You know, the famous line about Attlee pulling up, an empty taxi pulling out up outside Downing Street and Clement Attlee getting out, or the one about you're drunk, yes, but in the morning I'll be sober and you'll still be ugly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The majority of those are old music hall jokes, which long predate Winston Churchill and which were often attributed to other people, which it seems to have been forgotten before Winston Churchill.
For those people that have enjoyed the book, I imagine some of them might say, oh, but who cares? Who cares if it's right or not? And obviously, I mean, this is a bit of a kind of a daft question, but it obviously matters. But why does it matter?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I was asked the same thing, actually, on the World Service yesterday morning. It matters immensely, because if you can't get Winston Churchill, the most significant recent historical figure in this country, right, what hope is there for getting the rest of it right? It's the same with World War II. World War II has become akin to a kind of faith in this nation. It's become like a religion. You know, Remembrance Sunday has turned into Remembrance Christmas, practically. It's become a festival of sorrow and mourning, in which we've turned all of the people who died in both world wars into sort of, you know, heroes and victims. But if we can't get Churchill right, there's no hope for the rest of it. And so it's very, very important to get Churchill right. And countries which properly examine their history do rather well. And the obvious example of that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Is Germany.
Yes.
Germany has a lot of faults and a lot of flaws, like all countries. But modern Germany, 21st century Germany, not necessarily 1960s Germany, but 21st Germany, century Germany, is very well versed in its own history and what went wrong.
There's a phenomenal essay at the end of Postwar by Tony Judd, where he writes this essay called "The Houses of the Dead," from the Houses of the Dead, and he says basically modern Europe is built on the ashes of the Holocaust. Each country, with the exception of Germany, each country to some extent is in kind of deep Holocaust denial. France, the Netherlands, governments, civil servants, police officers all collaborated. And he makes the point, Anne Frank was arrested by Dutch police officers, not by Gestapo. Mm. And he said, Germany, because of the kind of the catharsis of war, is the only country that has really seriously looked at its past and the only country that is having a seriously honest conversation with itself. And I think, well, it would be nice to think that you don't have to go through all of that to have a moment of clarity. But I have this deep sense that, I mean, we're in a moment of profound national malaise, perhaps as a result of Brexit, almost irreversible national decline, I would surmise, so other people might disagree. And much of this is built on fantasy, and there are public propagators of fantasy. I recall a few weeks ago, there was something said by Dominic Sandbrook, who, at least three of his books I've really enjoyed and thought were really good, saying that the story of the little ships at Dunkirk, whilst not really being the truth, is that it's a great story, though. Shouldn't we just tell stories in history classes?
So Dominic Sandbrook hammered my book. He absolutely hated it and wrote a blistering review for Unheard, or Unhinged, as I like to call them. I agree with you. I quite enjoyed Dominic Sandbrook's sort of cut and paste 1980s television programs, and things like that. And I thought he made some pertinent points. You know, he's perfectly entitled to his opinion of my book. But returning to the point we were making a few minutes ago, when somebody who has positioned themselves as a serious historian starts saying that the little ships myth doesn't matter and that it's a good story, you've got to start asking serious questions about how long you can take him seriously as a historian. It's absolute nonsense. You know, that myth and World War II was fundamental to Brexit. They used all of the symbolism of it. They evoked the war, they evoked the sacrifices of war as their cause for Brexit. And Dominic Sandbrook seems to have jumped very much on board the Brexit bandwagon and doesn't like anybody questioning the myth. It's the H.G. Marshall stuff, isn't it? It's the Our Island story thing, which again I read for the book, building this lengthy narrative of this lengthy origin myth all the way back. I mean, have you ever read H.E. Marshall's book?
Dipped into it in many, many years ago.
So that book was brought back into print by a think tank, Civitas. I can't remember the year. I think it was 2005, 2006. And in a sort of cultural mission, which many people seem to have forgotten, Civitas got into bed with the Daily Telegraph, and they got all these people on board, including Michael Gove, who backed this narrative, which starts with the most ridiculous. I mean, the first two or three chapters of Our Island Story are about Alba and about giants roaming the land and all of this kind of stuff. I mean, it's utter fairy tale drivel. But the origin story then arcs out into this narrative of inevitability, of destiny, of England and later Britain carving its way and learning from its mistakes. Mm. It's a sort of serious 1066 and all that.
Well, this was the sort of stuff that in the high Victorian era, people like Macaulay and Trevelyan wrote to say, how did things work out as well as they have done?
Yeah.
And
but you see, Dominic Sembrook's attitude seems to be a later version of that. It's like these stories matter because they've created our national collective ideology and our national collective story, and they matter to us. I mean, I think that's dangerous. I think it's behind Brexit. And I think it's also an insult to people who were in the Second World War, who actually went through it, and who then, for the most part, voted for a better world. They rejected Churchill. They rejected the Conservative Party. They embraced the ideas of the NHS and state education. They wanted to move away from it. But the generations that followed, including mine, the people born in the late 60s and early 70s, of which I assume Dominic Sembrook is one, a lot of those people could never let it go. It was like a wound that people had to keep scratching. And this sentimentalized war version of the past, where Victor Comics and Action Men, it's childish, really, and it's definitely not history.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there is in any other post-colonial European country, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, there isn't, to the best of my knowledge, a version of this kind of this kind of culture. I mean, there is a conservatism in and a nostalgia and a far right in all of those countries for sure. Mm-hmm. But there isn't a kind of a version of this sort of national myth of kind of war, sacrifice, privation, victimhood, heroism, this kind of cluster of things that you see on Remembrance Sunday. And I suppose part of that is due to the fact that there were the traumas of a kind of defeat and occupation. Part of that is to do with the process of European integration after the war. But I think Britain hasn't been able to shed its exceptionalism in the way that other countries have. I'm guessing that's got to do with perhaps the kind of the unique circumstances of British history in the 20th century, I'm guessing. What do you...
Yeah, I mean, well, I think all countries have exceptional ideas about themselves. You know, all countries put themselves at the centre of the maps. You know, most do. Certainly the countries in Southeast Asia that I visited 20, 30 years ago, they've all placed themselves firmly in the centre of the map. I mean, people go, oh, the British do that. Well, everybody does that to some extent. And the French certainly have exceptional ideas about their cuisine and their wine and their culture, and with good justification, to be honest. But anyway, but you're right. I think because we won, or consider that we won and we stood alone, we do believe that we have sort of inherited the world, and yet we know we haven't, because post-war Britain had industrial decline, had huge social problems, and so maybe we sort of clung on to that prize of winning the war as the other countries leapfrogged over us and advanced into European by the EEC initially, and Britain sort of thought, hold on, we won, why are you all doing better than us? And then started hammering at the door, trying to get in from the 1960s, well, late 50s, early 60s onwards. So, I think also, and I think it's another thing which people don't really like to talk about, our propaganda became entertainment.
Yeah.
In Germany, they put the propaganda away because they had to, they'd lost. You couldn't start having, you know, the Olympic propaganda movies shown on primetime TV. But in England, in Britain, films like Went the Day Well became staples of afternoon television. The Michael Powell films did too, you know. They were propaganda films funded by the Ministry of Information, but they became light entertainment, and continue to be watched.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the war films of the kind of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there's this kind of fascinating blend of kind of triumphalism, regret, and Pyrrhic victories, and things like Too Far and The Bridge on the River Kwai. Well, there is that sort of element of was it all a bit of a wasted endeavor, or was this kind of we sort of a bit like kind of the elves in Tolkien, we've reached our peak and we're retiring now, we're sort of drifting out of things, and there is, I mean, some of them are, you know, the Bridge on the River Kwai particularly is a fantastic movie.
It is, yeah.
But
the early 50s ones, I can't remember, when was the Bridge on the River Kwai? Bridge on the River Kwai was a 50s one. The 50s, I mean, I love cinema and I love and I'm fascinated with war films as well. The 50s ones are fascinating because they do acknowledge the many of the people in those films presumably would have actually been in the war. So yeah. They knew it. And they're all very believable. That the original Dunkirk film, which again was made in the 50s, which I watched the other day, apart from propping up the whole little ship's myth, it's quite a good film and quite realistic in parts. You know, there's a retreating platoon with the Germans advancing and they're in a state of panic and they consider surrendering and all these very un-British things, which I'm sure audiences of the time would have recognized. So yeah, you're right there. And the Wooden Horse, one of the first escape movies, is very, very realistic, particularly in its treatment of resistance, because once they escape, they sort of fall into the hands of a group of French resistance people who don't trust them. They think they're infiltrating them. Well, that SOE type stuff is all very true and honest. But the further we go on, so by the late 60s, by the time of Where Eagles Dare, it's turned into something quite different. It's a much more sort of action type war movie. And all that nuance has gone and the Nazis have become sort of prototype Star Wars stormtroopers, haven't they? They've become some faceless. Yeah.
Well, Lee, I mean, there is always room for, I mean, and I've many a film I've forgiven for a bit of license. I mean, if you think the King's Speech, a wonderful film, but it makes this huge, huge howling error that Winston Churchill was initially a supporter of George VI, and he wasn't. He was, he apparently, you can debunk this in your follow-up question. Came into the House of Commons roaring drunk and said that they should form the King's Party during the abdication crisis to support Edward VIII. And that, you know, that doesn't really feature in the film at all. And there will always be, in fiction, there will always be license, you know. But here, we've reached this kind of almost postmodern sort of point where you have this arch kind of charlatan in the guise of Boris Johnson, who is quite explicit when he in the idea that truth doesn't really matter. I mean, and who actually cares? And so we've kind of boiled history down to this sort of entertainment product. along with like Marvel films. You know, it's just another thing you consume for enjoyment. I mean, the Boris Johnson book is the sort of thing you get a slightly conservative leaning aunt or uncle at Christmas time, and they can have a nice glass of port on the sofa and leaf through it and have a chuckle. And that's the point. But perhaps there needs to be some sort of move towards rebranding it into the light entertainment part of the bookshop.
What I found with the book, really interesting, actually, and hopefully, you know, other more academically minded people than me will do more of this. A lot of people, these stories are so well known that the sort of reveal in my book has sort of stunned people. I mean, I've had masses of messages from people going, their jaw was on the floor. I mean, you know, particularly the story of Churchill in the First World War going into the trenches. I mean, many of us, I mean, I'll be honest, until I researched the book, I didn't know the extent of that lie. You know, he did go into the trenches in the First World War. We've all been brought up with that story of how incredibly brave he was. But to the extent where I had the impression that he was just about the only politician who went to the front in the First World War. But I think it was well over a third. I think heading towards half of MPs were in uniform. Mm-hmm. And many died. And many were there for the extent of the war. Churchill was just there for a few brief weeks, you know. But people like those stories. But actually now, I think they know them so well, debunking them kind of fascinates people.
Yeah.
I think that there is value in it. Yeah.
I mean, there's this, not that I'm much of a psychologist, but in terms of kind of confirmation bias and narratives we recognise and stories that help the world to make a sort of sense, those are generally, you know, much more emotionally with people because, well, human beings, we function on stories, don't we? You know, if you look at any aspect of the world around you, it's a kind of a narrative that's being told. And a simple one that sort of makes the world make sense, normally in like a Manichaean light versus dark, good versus evil sort of way.
Yeah,
that's fine. Elements of ambiguity and complexity people shy away from an awful lot, making sweeping generalizations about the whole of humanity there. But you know, the role of the historian is to really, I believe, embrace complexity and nuance and, you know, that kind of thing, which I believe you have successfully done with your book.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I wanted it to be populist as well. I mean, I thought I didn't want, I mean, I'm not a historian. I mean, I did history A level, but that's the extent of it. I'm obviously fascinated by history. But a lot of what I've written over the years has been about the sort of contradiction between what we are told now about the wars, for example, and what I grew up with. I mean, my father fought in the Second World War. One of my grandfathers fought in both world wars, and my other grandfather fought in the first. None of those people, and obviously I had uncles and an aunt actually who were all in uniform during the Second World War, none of those people romanticized it at all, you know. And my father was at the hard end of things. He was in Italy in 1944, so he was at Casino, Monte Cassino and all of those places. So none of them romanticized it. They had funny stories that they would tell, things like that. But and I remember my father was a very conservative man, you know. He was literally a conservative councillor, and my mother worked for Erin Eve, the conservative MP. So my parents were total Tories. They were also both incredibly pro-European.
Yeah.
Because, as my father would frequently say, I don't want what I had to go through to ever have to happen to you. You know, that was it. That was the mantra. So those things and the contradictions between that and what we're now told, I think kind of sparked the book. And I wanted to tap into that. And I wanted it to be a popular book. I wanted it to be something people picked up and read who weren't necessarily hugely interested in history, because they're the people that need to be reached. It's the vast majority of people who sort of jog along and trot along, who take a passing interest or who might watch a History Channel documentary, but who sort of just take it all at face value. I mean, because people like yourself and hopefully Dominic Sambrook deep down know the truth, you know, but most people don't.
No. Well, there we must finish. Thank you so much, Otto. It's been a real, real pleasure. And Fake History can be found in all good bookshops. Just a message to the readership. I've encouraged people to endorse a local bookshop, to almost adopt a local bookshop and buy it from there and buy it mail order. I don't know if you have a favoured independent bookshop that you buy things from. If so, or if there's one down your high street, people can pick up a copy from.
Hive is good. Remember, Hive is good for tapping into those local bookshops. There are other websites available, but you can get them. You can get books via local bookshops on Hive, can't you?
Hive, that's right. Okay, yeah. So check it out there, and thank you so much. It's been a real, real pleasure, and we'll finish there.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.